I'm sick and tired of you, just like I'm sick and tired of these people. You're going to see something new in the Pringle Dynasty, brother. Rick Rude, Dola Duke, and there's no telling what other surprises I have in store for you. Gerhardt, get out of my way. Mobile, I love you.
Last at the Fat Man. Go ahead. Here's your chance. Go ahead and laugh at me. Stand up. Call me names. Do what you want to do. Here's your chance.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday, dear Alan.
Is this great or what, McMahon?
I can't believe this.
You could never understand the darkness, Kane. That is why I'll never have any use for you again.
He's your son, for God's sakes, you rotund demon.
She was a moaning and a groaning and a screaming, and I heard some little feet coming down the stairs. It's a good thing I got up, because it was Little Taker coming down the stairs. I stopped him just in time. And then it took two more steps. He didn't see his mama's feet. One of them was in New York, and the other one was in L.A.
I'm Paul Bearer, and you're not.
He will not grow old like we who are left grow old. Age shall not weary him, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember him. Goodbye, old buddy.
Welcome to episode 264 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, March 10th, 2013. I am the Solid Monster. Some sad news to start out the show with this week, obviously, as you all know by now. Paul Bearer, Percy Pringle, call him what you will, Bill Moody is his real name, passed away earlier this week on Tuesday at the age of 58. Cause of death is not yet known, although there are reports that he was suffering from a blood clot last weekend. He was admitted to a hospital and I believe passed away in the hospital on Tuesday night. Whether it's from the blood clot or not, I'm sure in due time, if the family wants to release that information, we'll know more. Moody lived in Mobile, Alabama, which is where he was apparently emceeing a Gulf Coast Wrestlers reunion type event. He was very involved in that sort of thing and making appearances each year at the Cauliflower Alley events in Vegas. If you're not familiar with Cauliflower Alley, you can go on their official website, which I believe is caulifloweralley.org. I could be wrong. It's, you know, fans can join. There's a membership fee, I believe, but you can join. You can attend the events. But really, it's an event to celebrate the careers of some great legends, and it really is more of a wrestler's event than anything else. They have a get-together every year. I know he's been a big part of that in the past, but he was emceeing a similar type of event in Mobile last week and showed up. There were reports that he didn't look very well. He looked very weak. He was coughing a lot. He had claimed that he had picked up a respiratory infection in Chicago the week before and had trouble standing up for long periods of time. So there was a sign there that there was some trouble, that he had not been feeling well. And, again, he was smart enough to check himself into a hospital, which is apparently how they discovered the blood clot, which was first reported by TMZ a couple of days ago. Again, whether that was the cause of death, we'll find out. He had been in poor health many, many years earlier because of his weight. Very well known that he had weight issues. I believe at one point his girth had ballooned up to something like 500 pounds at his worst. He had the gastric bypass surgery, as many of you are aware, back in 2003. That was paid for by WWE. It was part of the agreement that the company had with him to bring him back, which they did at WrestleMania 20. When Paul Bearer reemerged as the manager of The Undertaker, that was part of the arrangement, that they would help fund his gastro surgery And I believe after that surgery, he had gone down significantly. He had lost something like 250 pounds or more. He looked to be in better shape. I think he has some other weight struggles because it looked like his weight had ballooned back up a little bit, then would go back down. So he was no stranger to having health issues before, but still, 58 years old is still very young. 58 is not old. And unfortunately, yet another wrestling personality from my childhood taken way too early. It's just very sad to see. Again, the circumstances are, I'm sure, are very different, I would hope, in this case than for a lot of other wrestlers who died young and stuff like that. But it's always a shame to hear about something like this. And he was still very active in wrestling, even though he wasn't doing anything with WWE. He had about a cup of coffee with TNA many, many years ago. He didn't last very long there. But he was still very active, again, with these different wrestling reunion-type events. He was, I believe he might have been the figurehead commissioner or authority figure for an independent promotion up in the Boston area that John Cena's father is involved in. I believe it's the Millennium Wrestling Federation, if I'm not mistaken. He was involved with Championship Wrestling from Florida, another independent promotion. Sean Ricker, young guy. Perhaps one day he'll be a star. He was Percy's protege, as Percy managed him. I posted a video up on my Facebook, actually, earlier this morning, or yesterday, I should say, of the most recent appearance he made that aired locally on TV. He was doing commentary during one of Sean Ricker's matches, and, you know, he looked a little bit older, and he looked very slimmer from his former days, but it was Percy Pringle in the flesh. He was, you know, being as rambunctious as I think many of us remember him being on TV. And Sean Ricker, for those of you, if that name does ring a bell at all, that was one of the names I reported on Essie Scoops last month, who had a tryout down in Tampa at NXT last month. So who's to say that he won't end up in WWE developmental soon enough? And I'm sure he must feel really bad right now. But must have been a thrill for him to be managed by the great Paul Bearer. And again, where does Paul Bearer rank as far as the realm of managers over time? First of all, I did a column. Let me just mention this first. I did a column for LayfieldReport.com, my latest column, which should be up by the time you listen to this, if you want to check that out. Kind of my memories of Paul Bearer, my homage, if you will, to his career. And I mentioned in there that, for me personally, Bobby the Brain Heenan is the measuring stick when it comes to professional wrestling managers. He is the greatest of all time. Some people may have other arguments for people like Cornette or Paul Heyman or even Paul Bearer. They're all great. But to me, Bobby Heenan is the measuring stick. He is the greatest of all time. But when it comes to Paul Bearer and it comes to Jim Cornette and it comes to Paul Heyman even, they're right up there. I mean, they're probably top five. You know, one of the greatest managers of his day. Not only is he, I mean, he's most well known, of course, for being paired off with The Undertaker, and we'll talk about that in a second, but he was paired off with other people during his WWE tenure as well. He was paired off with Vader. He was paired off with Mankind. He was paired off briefly with Terry Gordy as the Executioner, who didn't last very long. Unfortunately, Gordy had his own health issues. And, of course, Kane, Paul Bearer's son, which to me is the crowning achievement in Bearer's WWE career. For all the great moments he had with Undertaker, and there were plenty of them, Kane's debut at the Bad Blood pay-per-view in 1997, to me, is still probably the greatest wrestling debut of all time. I think I did a list for SE Scoops once where I ranked the top debuts, or at least I thought about doing one. Maybe I didn't actually do it, but I know I've talked about this on this show before, and Kane's debut is right up there with Chris Jericho, and Taz was another one. But Kane's debut was just handled so magnificently. And Paul Bearer was great. You know, the image of Bearer coming out with Kane, almost like the shadowy, fat little figure in the background, you know, with Kane coming out there and the flames shooting up behind them. And, of course, Kane rips the door off the hinges of the Hell in a Cell and attacks The Undertaker. It was a great classic moment. And when you think back to Paul Bearer's career, there's really a lot of them. There really is. And I cannot think of another manager, and that includes Heenan, who has had as many epic returns and comebacks. You know, normally you don't think of that when it comes to managers because they're just a manager. You know, they're not meant to be the story. They're not meant to be the featured performer. Their whole purpose typically is to be there to help push somebody else and get somebody else over. It's kind of like what they're doing now with Zeb Coulter on TV with Jack Swagger. Zeb Coulter is there to be Swagger's mouthpiece because that's his weakness. He's there to help get Swagger over. Paul Heyman does most of the talking when it comes to Brock Lesnar, which is for the better, because Brock, you know, Brock in UFC was certainly a great promo. In wrestling, I've never looked at Brock Lesnar as being a terribly great promo. So where Paul Heyman comes in is to be somebody's mouthpiece, because he's very, very good at that. And Paul Bearer was also very, very good. He's very funny. He's a very funny guy. Lots of funny Paul Bearer quotes and moments from over the years. But just to go back to the whole returns thing that I mentioned, he's come and gone numerous times over his career in WWE. I think back to February of 2000, the episode of Raw, I'll never forget it, from the Reunion Arena in Dallas. One of the greatest Raw matches, I should say, of all time. I know I ranked it pretty high when I did episode 228 of the Sound Off, and I ranked my top 30 Raw moments. I talked about the 10-man tag from that show. It was The Rock, Cactus Jack, and Too Cool with Rikishi against Triple H and the Radicals, which were Saturn, I think X-Pac, Benoit. I know Eddie was not in that match because he had injured himself. And it was a great match, but the post-match also stands out to me, because what happened is there's this gigantic beatdown going on in the middle of the ring. The heels are beating up the baby faces. All of a sudden, the lights go out. And who should emerge but Paul Bearer, a very slim version, might I add, of Paul Bearer, who lost some weight even back then, I guess, before he put the weight back on. And he comes out, and the place just comes unglued. And then Kane makes his comeback. Kane had been off TV for a couple of weeks. So that was a very epic return. If you go back and watch that video, the place is going nuts. People are going crazy. He was part of that. WrestleMania 20, I mentioned a moment ago, him coming back to manage The Undertaker, who had just come back at WrestleMania as the Dead Man. Undertaker and Paul Bearer, they just go together like peanut butter and jelly. And that was a very special moment to see the two of them back together. And then I think back even to 2010. You know, Kane is the World Heavyweight Champion. They did an angle on SmackDown where a red casket is rolled down to the ring. Obviously, we're meant to assume it's The Undertaker inside the casket, who had been feuding with Kane at the time. Kane lifts the lid up, and who should be in the casket but Paul Bearer. Paul Bearer is laying in the casket right next to the urn. He raises up, kind of like The Undertaker does. And it was a great, epic moment. It's not just that he kind of reappears on television or anything like that. And I mentioned Zeb Coulter a while ago. When we saw Zeb Coulter first make his appearance on Raw earlier this year, he literally just showed up one week and he started walking down the aisle with Jack Swagger. And, you know, Paul Bearer had this this great run of comebacks where every time he would make a return to television, he did so with an impact. And I can't think of any other manager who really made that same sort of impression that he did when it came to that kind of thing. I think back to when he first started in WWE, and obviously he had a career before that. You know, he was known as Percy Pringle III down in, I want to say, Championship Wrestling from Florida back in the mid-80s. He had the Pringle Dynasty that he ran. He managed Rick Rude. He managed The Undertaker long before they ever were put together in WWE. It might have been when Undertaker was Texas Red or something like that. He managed a lot of people. And he came over to WWF at a time when the Undertaker character had recently been unveiled. Ted DiBiase, of course, effectively introduced the Undertaker at the Survivor Series in 1990 as his mystery partner. He came out managed by Brother Love. And to this day, I don't really understand the association between Brother Love and the Undertaker. I just think they wanted a manager for this guy. They decided to put Pritchard with him. And then a couple of months later, they realized either A, this isn't working, or B, hey, we got an even better idea. Let's bring in, you know, Bill Moody. We'll call him Paul Bearer. He has a legitimate background in mortuary science. I mean, for God's sakes, I say in my Layfield column that with Paul Bearer and The Undertaker back then, it literally was the match made in hell. It was a perfect match. You had this character, this undead reaper who comes to the ring collecting souls, and he just looks, you know, evil and demonic, and he's managed by a guy that calls himself Paul Bearer, who in real life happens to be involved in, you know, he's a licensed mortician. He's involved in funerals and death and bodies and all that kind of stuff. It just was the perfect fit. And Paul Bearer was the perfect complement to the Undertaker character, because the Undertaker character, quite frankly, did not do a lot of talking back then. You know, he wasn't supposed to talk. He was supposed to just walk very slowly down to the ring and choke people and beat them up, drop them on their head, and go back. You know, that was what the Undertaker was all about. And Paul Bearer would be there to cut the promos and say, you know, oh, yes, and all of that sort of stuff. And hold the urn up, which would give Undertaker his power when Undertaker was in a bit of trouble. You know, raise the urn up in the air, and the Undertaker would draw power from it. You always wondered when you were younger, what is in the urn? You know, you assume ashes were in the urn. There was at least one time when Hulk Hogan went into the urn and we saw ashes, so we knew that. But, you know, whose ashes are they? You know, are they his parents? Are they his friends? Is it his dog's ashes? You never really could figure out exactly why the Undertaker drew such strength from that urn. And it worked. You know, that combination worked. It worked for 6 years before Paul Bearer finally turned heel. He turned on the Undertaker. I'll always remember that Boiler Room Brawl from SummerSlam in 1996, which, by the way, I think is a very underrated match. As far as brawls go, as far as being something unique, I thought that was a very good match. Paul Bearer hits Undertaker in the head with the urn, aligns himself with Mankind, and basically becomes an enemy of the state. Undertaker makes Paul Bearer his target thereafter. And every time Paul Bearer would be assaulted by the Undertaker in some way, it was just comical the way that he would, you know, freak out. And he was a funny guy. And the one time that wasn't so funny was at an In Your House pay-per-view in 97 when they used the Flash paper, which they sometimes would use as a gimmick. And Undertaker set it on fire, and he actually threw it in Paul Bearer's face. He was crouched down in the corner. And obviously Undertaker didn't really mean to hurt him, because they were very close, and still were close up until the time of his death. But Undertaker chucked it in his face, and he suffered some severe burns to his face, so that wasn't very funny. But you fast forward to the Attitude Era, the Kane storyline, the slow build to that, which looking back was actually quite genius, I must say. I mean, you look at the success of that whole storyline, the fact that Kane, to this very day, 15 years later, is still as prolific a performer in the company as he is. I mean, I know he's doing the comedy thing right now with Daniel Bryan, but he can go from doing that to being a main event heel next week if they wanted him to, and the people still go nuts for Kane. And I think a lot of Kane's success should be credited to Paul Bearer and the effort that he put in to help get that character over back in the day. I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. And I think back to that period, and there was that one episode of Raw where I think Kane and Steve Austin shoved him down a manhole, which in later years on his blog, you know, Percy talked about that, and that was probably the least favorite thing he ever did, because it actually was quite a steep drop. So I'm sure that wasn't very fun, especially for a guy of his size. And speaking of his size, you know, obviously they would make fun of him quite a bit on television for being a very large man. He would poke fun at himself. He would come out on television a couple of times and tell the people to go ahead and laugh at the fat man. Jim Ross once referred to him as a rotund demon. Jerry Lawler had a great joke that I put in my Layfield column once that I remember, where he said that Paul Bearer had more chins than a Chinese phone book, which I thought was hilarious. Back when Jerry Lawler actually was funny, very long time ago. But the segment on Raw back in 98, which I've linked to on my Facebook, my all-time favorite Paul Bearer skit or segment, call it what you will, it was filmed as though it was not supposed to air. So basically they were throwing it to a commercial break. Jerry Lawler was backstage in the dressing room. He was going to interview Paul Bearer. And they go to commercial, but they keep the camera running. So it's supposed to look like they don't realize the camera's running. Obviously, the whole thing was planned, but camera guy sets the camera down, and we see Paul Bearer and Jerry Lawler kind of sitting down on a bench, and Lawler is prodding him for details about the night that he basically boinked the Undertaker's mother. So he shares the details of their sexual escapades and talks about the fact that, you know, Jerry, back then, I was actually quite studly. And he talks about how he had Undertaker's mother. He was nailing the Undertaker's mother. And, you know, her feet were up in the air. One foot was in L.A. The other was in New York. And you got to watch the segment to do it justice. Just hilarious stuff. He knew how to play his character so well. He was such a vile, disgusting, creepy, you know, fat little man. That's what Paul Bearer was back then as a heel. And he was just so, so entertaining in that role. And, you know, these days we have Miz TV. We've had tons of different interview segments over the years. Chris Jericho has, you know, the highlight reel. Edge had the Cutting Edge. Carlito had his Cabana. I mean, there's been so many that go back over the years. And one of the original in WWF, obviously, you had Piper's Pit. You had Rogers Corner with Buddy Rogers, which may have been the original talk show segment in the old WWWF. But the funeral parlor, that's one of the memories I have from when I was young in that late 80s, early 90s time period. You know, I guess in this case it would be early 90s after Undertaker debut, Paul Bearer hosted the funeral parlor. And he would have a lot of very high-profile guests. The two funeral parlor segments in particular that stand out to me that are my favorite, and I know in this case, this one was actually Percy's favorite because he talked about this, was the one that he did with Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair. This was when Flair had just come over to the World Wrestling Federation. He was walking around with the big gold belt, calling himself the Real World Champion. So there he is, face-to-face with the WWF Champion on the funeral parlor. You see Paul Bearer in between them with the microphone, you know, interviewing them. And he's talked about the fact before that that's when he knew he made it. You know, he had done, for all the stuff he had done in wrestling up to that point, he knew he made it to the big time when he was on the stage, sharing the stage with Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair, the two biggest stars in all of wrestling at that point. And, of course, Undertaker was hidden in one of the coffins that was standing upright, that was part of the set. Undertaker emerged, he attacked Hogan, Randy Savage and Roddy Piper tried to rescue him. It's a very memorable segment. The other memorable funeral parlor that stands out to me is the one that hosted Jake the Snake Roberts. This was in 1992, so this was part of the build-up to WrestleMania 8. And Jake at this point was a vicious heel. You know, he had long abandoned his babyface ways, and he was... this was right after the Savage feud, in fact, which I thought was cut short, and they could have done a lot more with it. But Jake had feuded with Savage, he had slapped Elizabeth, all this stuff between them, and Savage had pretty much finished Undertaker off on a Saturday night's main event. They did the blow-off. I don't know why they didn't save the match for WrestleMania, but they blew it off. And they did an angle that turned Undertaker babyface, and by proxy turned Paul Bearer babyface as well, where after Jake lost, he went backstage. He was hiding behind the curtain with a chair, and he was threatening to nail Elizabeth and Randy Savage with the chair when they came through the curtain. And so here they come, and the curtain pulls back, and you see Jake kind of wielding the chair backwards, but the Undertaker is there. He grabs the chair out of his hand, and that's how the Undertaker turned babyface, which is kind of weird looking back on it. Seems kind of uneventful, but this led to the funeral parlor segment where Jake is being interviewed by Paul Bearer, and the Undertaker comes out, and Jake slams the casket lid on the Undertaker's hand, which, again, when, you know, as a younger fan at that time, I'm watching this going, oh, you know, how'd they do that? You know, it looks like they really slammed the lid down on his hand. That must really hurt. And so anyway, he slams the lid down on the Undertaker's hand, and he grabs Paul Bearer, and he gives Paul Bearer a DDT on the stage. And Undertaker is being assaulted now by Jake with the steel chair, but Undertaker is literally dragging this gigantic casket with his hand trapped in it, just dragging it like an undead zombie, walking towards Jake. Everything Jake is doing to this guy is having no effect. And that to me, that's the real Undertaker character right there. Of all the incarnations of the Undertaker character, to me, that's my most favorite. Some people might like the American Badass. I know a lot of people like Big Evil, which I became a fan of after a while. But that original Undertaker incarnation, in particular after he turned babyface, that's the one that I look back on fondly. And that's when it all began. So I look back on those funeral parlor segments very fondly. I look back on his entire run very fondly. We lost a good guy here. And if there's any solace to take away from this story, which is very sad, it concerns his wife Diana, who passed away 4 years ago from breast cancer. I believe she actually battled it twice. I think she went into remission the first time, then the cancer came back. She was undergoing chemotherapy. Anybody who has had cancer or has had a family member who has gone through cancer knows that oftentimes it's not the cancer that will kill you, it's the treatment. Chemo is a bitch. And so this is what this poor woman had to go through, and she died. She died in 2009. And I used to follow Percy's blog, which he used to maintain more often online. You could just tell he was never really the same after that. Again, I don't claim to know him personally. I never even had the chance to meet him and shake his hand and say hello, which is one of my regrets. Because last year in Miami, of course, I had a chance to meet Bobby Heenan, which was a big thrill for me. But we also had a chance to do Fan Access for the first, in my case, for the first time at WrestleMania. I had done a fan festival type thing back in 94 when they first started it, but this was the first time I had a chance to really do all the attractions at the Fan Access. It really is something, if you've never done it before, it's worth doing it at least once, and we'll be doing it again this year. But last year they had the Undertaker's Graveyard exhibit. So we were able to go in, and they have all these mock tombstones set up with the names of all of Undertaker's fallen WrestleMania opponents. The Undertaker theme music is playing in the background. It's dark. It's, you know, they have the dry ice, so you have smoke all over the place. They have an open grave with a shovel where you can, you know, dump dirt in the grave. Really well done. And they have the old funeral parlor set. Now, I know that Paul Bearer was part of Access last year. Some of you even got your picture with him. You posted it. One guy posted it on Facebook. We happened to not be around when he was doing his signing session, so I had been hoping perhaps to meet him, and we didn't have that opportunity, and that's one of the things that now I look back on, of course, and I regret the fact that I didn't have a chance to meet him. So that's a shame. But what I could take solace in is knowing how hurt he was when his wife passed away, and anybody would be. I mean, they were married for 31 years. I mean, my parents were married for 31 years. They just got a divorce last year. Now they hate each other's guts. But these two was a completely different story. I mean, obviously these two loved each other very much, and I'm sure it could not have been easy for him to watch his wife slip away like that. And you can read his blogs after that, and you can just feel the pain and the anguish in his voice. And I'm sure now that he has been reunited with his wife, hopefully he's happy wherever he is. And that's one of those things that you could look at and say, okay, you know, as horrible and sad as this is, there is kind of a silver lining in that, and I think that would be it. he does have some children and grandkids, actually. His son Daniel is an independent wrestler. He wrestles independently as DJ Pringle. And that brings me to the Hall of Fame question, which has been talked about a lot over the course of this past week. Should WWE induct Paul Bearer into the Hall of Fame this year at Madison Square Garden? And if so, who handles the induction? You know, one of the really sad aspects here, it's really doubly sad. It's sad because now that he's passed away, much like Randy Savage, he won't have the opportunity to be there to accept his Hall of Fame ring and to give a Hall of Fame speech, which I would have loved to have heard. That's the problem when you wait, you know, far too long to put people in the Hall of Fame who should already be there. They're lucky Bruno Sammartino was still alive and kicking in his 70s, and he'll be there to do his induction in April. But unfortunately, Paul Bearer won't have that same luxury, and I think that's a shame. And it's also a shame that he won't be able to induct The Undertaker when he eventually goes into the Hall of Fame. I had always assumed, as I'm sure most of you probably have, that Paul Bearer would probably be the best person to do that induction when that day comes, and now he won't be able to do that. It'll probably fall to Kane, would be my guess. But as far as the Hall of Fame and Paul Bearer, I do think it would be very cool for him to go in this year at the Garden, and not just because I'm going to be there, which, you know, obviously I have an interest in wanting to see him go in because he's very deserving. They have not yet announced any posthumous induction, so it's not like they've already announced somebody for the Hall of Fame who's already passed on. And I know they don't like, you know, doing that more than once in a single year. So he could be the posthumous induction that they put in. You know, obviously it's fresh in everybody's minds. Eddie Guerrero, when he passed away in late 05, he went into the Hall of Fame the very next year. I think it would be appropriate for him to go in, and if he does go in, I think that it's Undertaker and Kane who should do the induction. Now, you could do either one on their own, but I think a double induction with Undertaker and Kane coming out and speaking, you know, on behalf of Paul Bearer. Both of them obviously were linked to Paul Bearer. Paul Bearer played a very pivotal role in both of their careers. They were both very good friends with him. They both kept in touch with him. And to the people saying, well, you know, I can't see Undertaker doing that. He's the dead man. It goes against his character. Believe me, we've seen The Undertaker plenty of times over the years speak like a normal person. Okay, it's not going to matter. This is not about characters. This is not about gimmicks. It's fine. I could easily see The Undertaker inducting Paul Bearer into the Hall of Fame this year. And I hope he does. And I hope it's him and Kane. You know, when they inducted, I mentioned Eddie a moment ago, when Eddie got inducted into the Hall of Fame, they had three different people up there doing the induction. So it's definitely possible. And as far as who accepts the award, again, why not his son? son's an independent wrestler. I'm sure he'd have no problem getting up there and doing a speech on his father's behalf. His father was very instrumental in getting him started in the business. If, again, anybody who followed along on his blogs and his Twitter would know that. But the other thing to consider also is if they wait until next year, I'm not sure that wouldn't even necessarily be better because, you know, Bearer was a big fan of Mardi Gras in New Orleans. He would post photos of him all dressed up in drag and stuff. I believe me, I will never forget the image of Paul Bearer dressed scantily, might I add, in drag with lipstick and the works. That was a photo he posted on his blog. It was him and a couple of buddies. I don't know if that photo was still floating around. I have not searched for it. I have no interest in searching for it. But I can tell you, he was a very big fan of Mardi Gras. He was very much into it. He attended it, you know, probably numerous times. And WrestleMania next year happens to be in the city of New Orleans, which I know he was very fond of. And so with WrestleMania being there, that also could be a very fitting place, I think, for him to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. So if he doesn't go in this year, it's not the end of the world, because I'm sure if he doesn't go in this year, he'll go in next year. And either location would be fine. But personally, I'd love to see him go in this year. I'd love to see Undertaker and Kane do the induction. I also would love to see Undertaker and Kane give some sort of salute to Paul Bearer on Raw this Monday night. Undertaker, I believe, is supposed to be... Actually, you know what? I take that back. I don't know that Undertaker is actually scheduled for Raw this week. I believe Undertaker is back on the 18th in Pittsburgh. So, actually, no. I don't think he is going to be on Raw this week. Oh, that sucks. There goes my idea. I figured doing something where Undertaker and Kane come out and maybe they both kind of go down on one knee and salute or something like that would be very cool. But if Undertaker's not there, obviously, it's going to be very difficult. So we'll get the tribute video. But that's my thought on the Hall of Fame. Hopefully they do it. Hopefully those are the people who induct him. I think that would be a very cool moment. And he will be missed. He will definitely be missed. I don't think that WWE, for the people who have asked about this, is going to use his passing to try to get more heat for CM Punk. I've had a couple of people ask me about that, and I don't blame them for asking me because it was only, you know, 6 years ago or 7 years ago that we saw, remember the whole Eddie's in Hell thing, where they had Randy Orton on television telling Rey Mysterio that Eddie Guerrero, who just died 3 months earlier, was down in hell somewhere. Which was an angle that neither one of them wanted any part of, but obviously they did it anyway. I would like to think that WWE isn't that dumb and insensitive, and so no, I don't see them, you know, I don't see them signing off on that. I don't think Punk would do that. So those are my thoughts on the passing of Paul Bearer. It's a shame that his last television appearance in WWE was in the inside of a meat locker. That was during the Kane-Randy Orton feud last year. But I think the outpouring of support that has been out there for him amongst the wrestlers all over Twitter and Facebook and TNA had a very nice little graphic they put up on TV before Impact this week, and they had a nice statement about him that they released. Because, again, he did briefly work for TNA not long, I think, after the company launched back during their NWA TNA day. So that was very classy on their part. Bruce Pritchard and Al Snow, also on television this week, had kind words to say about Paul Bearer. The guy was loved by a lot of people, and I think that speaks volumes about his place in the business, and he will be missed. Raw this past Monday night from Buffalo, New York, was Old School. The second time WWE has hosted an Old School edition of Raw, the first and only other time was in November of 2010, which was my favorite Raw that year. A lot of divided opinion about this show on Facebook. I put a thread up the day after Raw basically asking people, yay or nay, what'd you think of the show? And there were about 60-something comments, I think, that were pretty evenly split. There were a lot of people who thought the show was okay, a lot of people who hated the show, a lot of people, well, some people anyway, who loved the show. A lot of just in the middle, kind of down the middle of the road opinion on this program here. I enjoyed the old school graphics, the metal barricades, the red, white, and blue ropes, the pyro, the siren, but, you know, I already saw that 3 years ago. They didn't really offer anything new. They didn't do enough, I don't think, to play off the whole old school theme. You know, where was the Fink? Why not let him handle the ring announcing for one night? Why not have Gene Okerlund backstage or in studio from Stanford giving us a WrestleMania report and running down the card? Now, maybe it's because before Monday we only had one match official for the pay-per-view. You can't have much of a WrestleMania report with only one match announced. I don't think they have officially announced Jack Swagger and Alberto Del Rio as being set for WrestleMania. I mean, he's the number one contender, but I don't think they've made it official yet. But on the plus side, you know, we got to see the Honky Tonk Man, who at least we haven't seen too much of on WWE television in recent years. I mean, we got the usual suspects. We got Dusty Rhodes, who did nothing. We had Sergeant Slaughter, who did nothing. Hacksaw Jim Duggan, who got his ass handed to him by Jack Swagger in about 30 seconds. I don't even think it was an official match. You know, it's always cool to see the Million Dollar Man, but he just kind of stood there on the outside during the Primetime Players match. I mean, why not let him do color commentary with Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler? You know, he may not move around too well these days. He actually just had both of his knees replaced. But he still has the gift of gab. I mean, let the guy speak. So instead, he just stood there. He said nothing. Ric Flair, at least, he got to throw some chops at Big E Langston during Dolph Ziggler's match against The Miz. I think it's high time they change things up with the legends whenever they do these types of shows and they have these cameos. It's the same faces all the time. I mean, where are guys like Rick Martel? You know, let's get the model out there. How about the Mountie? Why not Demolition? They were my favorite tag team growing up. I mean, just make amends with Axe already and get those guys back on TV. King Kong Bundy claimed that he was invited to attend, but he politely turned them down. So at least if he is to be believed, they at least invited him to attend, and he said no. The problem, though, you know, so many of the guys from that era are gone. I mean, I just did a eulogy at the beginning of the show for another dead wrestling personality, unfortunately, but there were so many wrestlers, actual wrestlers, who died much younger than Paul Bearer. You know, Mr. Perfect, Big Boss Man, Earthquake, Rick Rude, Owen Hart, British Bulldog, Randy Savage, who wasn't young, per se, but what I mean is all those personalities from that era, that late 80s, early 90s era, it's actually really depressing. So, you know, I understand the fact that you can't have those guys because they're just not around anymore. But surely there are other people who are still breathing that you can find for these types of shows. The really funny thing, though, about that whole setup, they went with the giant Raw letters as an entranceway with the basic Titantron screen, no fancy HD set that they spent, you know, millions of dollars on. You know what? Honest to God, I wouldn't mind it one bit if they used that set for Raw every single week. I really liked it. My biggest problem with the show had nothing to do with the old school theme per se. It really hit me this week that Raw is 3 hours now. That's one whole hour more than they had this time a year ago. And yet, these days, almost nobody gets a full entrance on TV. I mean, have you noticed this? This new trend here? I mean, I know they don't do pyro anymore because they're trying to cut costs. Aside from the old school pyro they had above the ring on Monday night, it's been months since we've seen pyro to open up a Monday Night Raw. Except on Main Event. Go figure that one out. They can't have pyro for Raw anymore, but Main Event on ION Television has pyro every single week. I mean, it doesn't bother me. I'm not a pyromaniac like Noah Mark is, but no pyro, hardly any entrances. And so you figure, you know, okay, maybe that means that there's more time for action, right? I mean, it makes sense. Wrong. We had that great 20-minute Main Event with CM Punk and John Cena 2 weeks ago. That was great, but that's the exception. You look at some of those matches on Monday. I mean, why even send those guys out there? The Brodus Clay Tenzai against 3MB tag team match. I mean, what the hell was that? Jesus Christ. I mean, I said it before they even started with these three-hour shows. I said if they use that extra real estate for more action, maybe some longer matches, or maybe they want to bring back the cruiserweights as kind of a fun feature for Raw. You know, people aren't really used to seeing that. So much like with Nitro back in the day, it might be a way to kind of reinvigorate the show and start Raw every week with a hot, like, 10-minute or 12-minute match with two cruiserweight guys to get the crowd pumped, and you go from there. They could have made the most of that extra time. Or, as I also predicted, they could just use that time to fit in even more shit that they normally try to fit in. And that's what we have now. They're just trying to fit in as many segments as they can instead of making the most of the segments that they already have. I mean, you've got 3 hours and 15 minutes for crying out loud. What are you in such a rush for? It really hit me this week. Undertaker made his return at the top of the show, looking very much like Super Shredder from that one Ninja Turtle movie. CM Punk beat Randy Orton, Sheamus, and Big Show in a fatal four-way to earn the right to challenge for the streak at WrestleMania. So he is going to try to break the streak against The Undertaker, which is a match that, of course, we've talked about here for months now. I thought the John Cena Rock segment on this show was fantastic. Maybe the best face-to-face these two have ever had, going back to last year's build-up for the match in Miami. I mean, Cena cut the crap. He got serious. He said some things that were cringeworthy, you know, like talking about last year's match again as a match that he just had to win. You know, I had to win that match. That match was my world. After I lost to The Rock, I felt worthless. He said his life went into a tailspin. So I guess we're supposed to forget the fact that all of 2 weeks after WrestleMania, Cena was on Raw joking around. I think it was in a segment with Vince McMahon, actually. He was on Raw joking around about how he lost, and it was really no big deal. So anyway, now it's a big deal to him, I guess. So there was still some of that bullshit in his promo, but very good overall. Cena quoted Mike Tyson. He said, you know, in order to be the greatest who ever lived, you have to beat everyone living. And Rock, for his part, was also great. He put John Cena over as being the only guy he wanted to face. He also quoted a famous athlete who once said, winning is about heart. You've just got to have it in the right place. And Rock told Cena the person who said that was Lance Armstrong, and he was full of crap, and so are you. I popped huge for that line. That was a fucking great line right there. And truthful, too. Lance Armstrong really is full of crap. But this is how you sell your WrestleMania main event. I mean, if anything, I think this promo may have peaked about 3 weeks too early, but there really isn't much here to criticize. I think I'm kind of reaching here if I'm going to criticize it for you know, coming 5 weeks before the show instead of two. I thought these guys did a hell of a job. I just hope they can keep whatever momentum they had for this match coming out of this segment, because they really nailed it here. And by the way, those ads that were out plugging Rock Wrestling at Extreme Rules in May, there were some rumors about that. Supposedly some advertisements were out that he would be on the show. Apparently it's legit. Rock is currently scheduled to be on the card at Extreme Rules in May. And he'll be wrestling beyond just WrestleMania, and I guess that's one of the dates that he has so far committed to. So if you're not a Rock fan, get used to it. He's not going away. Triple H came out to cut a promo on Brock Lesnar. He challenged him to a fight at WrestleMania. He talked about watching his wife and his kids crying in the hospital as they looked at their grandfather, and Stephanie looked at her father laying there crippled. So that's why he came back. Pretty basic stuff. You know, he made his case. The crowd really did not seem to care less about what he was saying, which I don't know what that means. You would think coming off that hot angle they did, the crowd would be into this, but they really weren't. So perhaps they were thinking back to the SummerSlam match last year, which I wasn't exactly a big fan of. Again, I wasn't looking forward to seeing Triple H and Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania. I was looking more forward to it after the pull-apart brawl last week. And I just hope that they've got some stuff planned. You know, Triple H has laid down the gauntlet. I assume Brock will accept, or, you know, maybe they'll milk it. Paul Heyman will speak for Brock, and he'll say no, and they'll kind of do that for a couple of weeks. I mean, we'll see what happens, but maybe part of the problem is that the crowd wanted to see Brock Lesnar. You know, they were waiting for destruction that never came because Brock was not on the show this week. The New Age Outlaws beat the Colognes in a tag team match, Primo and Epico, and they even got an entrance. They were one of the few who actually got an entrance on this show. The Outlaws looked very good, especially Road Dogg. He still moves around in there like it's 1999. Billy Gunn won with the Famouser on Primo. Backstage, they filmed an interview with the Outlaws that went up on WWE.com where they accepted the challenge from the Rhodes Scholars. Apparently, Cody and Damian Sandow had laid down a challenge to the Outlaws for a match on Raw this upcoming Monday night. They accepted, and so we're going to see the Outlaws again on TV this week. I saw that match already at the Madison Square Garden house show that we were at in December. The Outlaws won that match. I see no reason for them not to win this week. And here's the thing. I mean, clearly they're not pushing Rhodes and Sandow. They're a joke. You know, I would love for them to push them and get serious. Apparently they're only back together. It's like a reunion tour. They don't know what the fuck they're doing with these guys. So I hope the Outlaws win, and I hope the Outlaws win because I want them to face Kane and Daniel Bryan for the tag team titles at WrestleMania. Why not? They can still go. They're still an attraction. People are still into them. The Outlaws got a bigger reaction on Monday night than most of the people who they trotted out there, including Triple H, by the way. I think they've got one more run left in them as champions, and they can work with some of the younger. They can do an extended program at that point with Rhodes and Sandow and maybe finally put those guys over. Maybe they'll finally win the belts, or they can work with another team. There's a lack of teams right now in WWE. There's, you know, Rey and Sin Cara. Rey's hurt, so he's not wrestling. You got the primetime players. If they want to maybe put the primetime players over, I could see them doing that. But why not put these guys in there? The New Age Outlaws are still a big deal to a lot of people. I think there'd be a lot of appeal in seeing the Outlaws wrestle for the tag titles at WrestleMania. You know, and if they want to get those other teams on the WrestleMania card, then throw them in a gauntlet match. Some sort of fatal four-way elimination match. You could have Kane and Bryan. You could have the primetime players. You could have the Outlaws. You could have the Usos, or maybe there's another team I'm forgetting about. Rhodes and Sandow. You know, you can do something like that, but I think the Outlaws should go to WrestleMania, quite frankly, and I'd put the titles on them. Not long-term, but why not? It's a feel-good moment. Why not? They're not too washed up where they can't go in there and have a good match. I wouldn't be saying this if it were Demolition. I mentioned them a little bit earlier. Obviously, Demolition has no business being back in the ring, let alone wrestling for the tag team titles. But based on what I saw this week and what I saw at the house show a couple months ago, I see no reason why they can't put the Outlaws in there and have them fighting for the belts. Plus, I think it's about time Kane and Daniel Bryan went their separate ways anyway, at least for Daniel Bryan's sake. I think that whole thing has run its course, so perhaps that would be a good way to get the belts off them. Antonio Cesaro lost to Ryback on this show. Wade Barrett lost to Alberto Del Rio. I mentioned this because it just begs the question, you know, why even have a U.S. and Intercontinental title? Why bother? What is the point? How many times have these guys lost on television? And not just lost on television, but lost in the same show. I don't get it. You can't find anybody else on the roster to feed to Ryback or feed to Del Rio. It has to be a champion. I don't get the logic there. I just don't understand. Please explain that to me. Mark Henry beat Zack Ryder in a match where if you blinked, you missed it. Thanks for coming, Zack. Just keep posting those tweets. Ryder was actually wearing new tights on Raw that read, "Push me" on the back. Push me. Right off a cliff, apparently. Fandango made his debut appearance on Raw. He was supposed to face Kofi Kingston in a match, which never happened because Justin Roberts had to go and fuck up his name, so he once again refused to wrestle. I bet Howard Finkel would have said the name right if he were doing the announcing on Monday. As far as this whole Fandango thing goes, he can Fandango fuck himself. This gimmick sucks. It's just terrible. And quite frankly, Johnny Curtis just isn't very good in the role. I know he hasn't exactly done much. He's made all of two appearances on television so far and hasn't even wrestled the match. But his speaking, you know, because he actually had some mic time on Monday. So he was speaking. And I don't know if it's because they have him doing that weird accent so he has to fake it or what the deal is here. Because Johnny Curtis is not a bad wrestler. I mean, he's been around forever. He's been in NXT. But, you know, he did some speaking on Monday. And boy, I got to tell you, it was not good. I don't think this is going to end well for the guy. You know, when Brodus Clay reappeared as the Funkasaurus, and everybody expected me to rant and rave about how terrible it was, they've ruined the guy, what are they doing? You know, I had some thoughts like that, don't get me wrong, but I actually stood up in defense of the character. I was gung-ho about the Brodus Clay character. I thought, you know what, let's give this a chance. This guy could have some potential, they could sell some merchandise, maybe he'll get over. If they handle this the right way, this could be something for him. You know, they could do the gimmick where he's dancing, he's smiling, he's happy, but when you really piss him off, he's got a mean streak, and he just flattens you. And unfortunately, that's not the direction they went in with it, and they killed the character. They got bored of it, I guess. You know, he was undefeated for a while, and then one week on Raw, they had Big Show just knock him out like a jobber. I actually had faith that it would get over and he would get over with it, and I was wrong. I'm man enough to admit when I'm wrong. So I will no longer allow these people to bamboozle me when it comes to these lame gimmicks. This Fandango thing ain't gonna work. So that was Raw for Monday night. Those are the key segments anyway. Really good stuff with Rock and Cena, and you know, the main event this week wasn't obviously as good as the week before, but They set up Punk and Undertaker. It's official for WrestleMania now, and be interesting to see what they do with that match. You would think the finish is a foregone conclusion. I am not so sure. I think there's at least a slim chance that Punk could go over, but probably not. Probably just wishful thinking on my part. A couple of other WWE news notes here. El Generico debuted at the local NXT show down in Tampa Thursday night. They had a show, and he debuted without his mask and without the El Generico name. So, in fact, they have stripped away the gimmick, which, you know, I would love to see him wrestling as El Generico at NXT, but if it's a matter of the company wanted to own the gimmick and he refused to give them the rights to it, then I understand, because let's say things don't work out for him, he could always go back on the indies and be El Generico again. So I don't know who's at fault for that, but he's going under the name, I don't know if it's pronounced Remy or Remy Sebi or Sebi or whatever. I don't know what the pronunciation of the name is. I mean, for fuck's sake, when I saw John Cena first wrestling in matches back when he was in OVW and doing dark matches, I thought his name was John Chayna. I was calling him John Chayna for the longest time until somebody finally smartened me up and said, no, idiot, his name is John Cena. So I don't know what the pronunciation of this guy's name is, but he teamed with Cassius Ohno. So basically, El Generico and Chris Hero teamed up, which is pretty cool. They fought the Wyatt family. So that's the update on Generico. And here's something that caught my eye from this week's latest edition of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. A fine publication, by the way. You may have heard that WWE has told the great folks down in Orlando, Florida, that they are free to submit a proposal to bring WrestleMania back to the city in 2015 or 2016. Which surprises me, because they were just in Orlando, and I know they put a lot of money into renovating the Orange Bowl, the Citrus Bowl, I should say, down there. But still, Noah Mark, for example, who is down in Florida and was at that WrestleMania, a lot of people have said that place is a dump. So this news surprised me when I read it. But what I found interesting in the item in the Observer is that it mentions the possible physical Hall of Fame building being housed down in Orlando, and that WWE is either considering or they've actually begun the process of putting thought into developing, I guess, what would be kind of a developmental complex down in Orlando. So we're not just talking about a facility where, like what they have now, like a gym type setting where you go and they do the training and they have matches and maybe they have some shows. It's almost like NXT University, which actually wouldn't be a bad name for it, but that's what it sounds like, creating some sort of program where they have actual classes that you take. Obviously, they have, like, you know, weight training and stuff like that, classes that teach you wrestling 101, the history of WWE and the history of the wrestling business. You have to watch tapes and DVDs. You have to submit reports, like homework and stuff like that. And the belief is that if they're going to put together a Hall of Fame building, it would be basically housed within this complex, within this facility. And so I guess the idea would be to run WrestleMania in Orlando, and that they can promote the opening, the grand opening of their Hall of Fame, and it would be a big deal. So I was most intrigued. I mean, forget the Hall of Fame. I figure one day there will be a physical building. I was more intrigued by this idea of NXT University, as I've dubbed it. I think that's a pretty kick-ass idea right there. I've said it before, I really like what Triple H is doing with developmental. I mean, he took it over and he has made it his baby. I don't know how deeply involved he is in that. There was no, you know, mention of him in the item, but he has taken kind of the bull by the horn, so to speak, when it comes to developmental, and I assume he is the point person on a lot of these changes, and I like these changes. I think these are positive changes, and I think NXT is in a much better position. They're in much better shape now with Triple H at the helm. They're actually putting some time and thought and money into their developmental system, which is something they should have done years ago. You had that period of just years in the 2000s, like the mid-2000s, the late-2000s, where, you know, they weren't exactly churning out talent the way they were earlier in the decade. It didn't seem like they were paying much attention to developmental, and you had a lot of lunks down there. And now they're finally putting some effort and attention to it, and I think it's starting to pay off, and hopefully it'll pay off even more in the future. So I just wanted to mention that. Let's talk about Impact from Thursday night. And before we even get to Impact, TNA has a pay-per-view tonight, in fact, Sunday, March 10th. It is Lockdown from the Alamo Dome in San Antonio, Texas. Apparently, TNA has already said they will have their largest U.S. audience to date. They're now aiming to sell some more tickets this weekend with whatever time is left, and perhaps by showtime they will announce that it is the largest TNA audience of any kind. But I guess right now they must have had some shows over in the UK with attendance that that bests whatever they've done so far in terms of ticket sales. But it will be the largest domestic audience for a TNA event to date after 10-plus years. We have World Heavyweight Championship on the line. Jeff Hardy defending against Bully Ray in the main event. It will be inside a steel cage. And I'm going with Bully Ray in this match. I think it's time. I think he's earned it. I think the metamorphosis from tag team wrestler to singles heel to now babyface, hopefully soon to be heel again, has been pretty amazing. He's gotten himself into shape. He's over. I think he deserves it. They've got Jeff Hardy apparently locked into a new contract, so they don't have to worry that, you know, they're going to take the title off him and piss him off and he'll leave or something like that. So I predict Bully Ray wins the world title. I think they do the heel turn. I think he joins Aces and Eights. I've been calling it for months. I mean, look, they could drag this out longer if they want to, but I think this is the time to do it, and I think we're going to see it. I think we got a new champion. Lethal Lockdown match, Aces and Eights. D-Von, Doc, Knox, Mr. Anderson, and Garrett Bischoff against Team TNA, led by Sting, Samoa Joe, James Storm, Magnus, and Eric Young. Look, I've joked about what a farce Aces and Eights is. You know, they lose matches repeatedly. I mean, they lose far more matches than they win, and it's a joke. The fact they're still unveiling new members and they're trying to get Aces and Eights over like some big threat to TNA, like, you know, if we don't eliminate Aces and Eights, the very survival of TNA may be, you know, in jeopardy. Give me a break. They've done nothing to convince us that Aces and Eights is any real threat at all. Except they run out there with hammers every now and then, and they bash somebody in the knee, and they run away. And you could easily avoid that if the TNA roster was so worried about that. You know, Aces and Eights has their own entranceway. They have their... Obviously, Kurt Angle found where their clubhouse was. I don't understand why they don't just send the whole goddamn roster to that clubhouse to beat the shit out of every member of Aces and Eights. If they're such a threat, why not do that? But that's thinking too much, apparently. So I have to think that they're going to do something here to make Aces and Eights stronger, because Aces and Eights ain't going away for a while. I think they're due for a big win. I think they get the big win. I'm going to go with Aces and Eights winning Lethal Lockdown. We have Wes Briscoe against Kurt Angle in a steel cage. I'm going with Kurt Angle in this match. Bobby Roode and Austin Aries are scheduled to defend their tag team titles in a triple threat match against both Chris Daniels and Frankie Kazarian and the team of Chavo and Hernandez. And this is an interesting situation here, because as I am recording the sound off here, early in the morning on the day of the Lockdown pay-per-view, there is some question as to whether or not Bobby Roode will not only be on the pay-per-view, but whether or not he'll even be with TNA. This is a late-breaking situation here, although apparently it's been ongoing for several weeks, but this news only first came to light publicly late last night, that Bobby Roode's contract with TNA may have expired, which would explain his absence from television over the last 2 weeks. You'll notice it's been 2 weeks on Impact that Bobby Roode has not been present, and Austin Aries has been on the show fending for himself. You know, 2 weeks ago he had the match against Hernandez. This past Thursday he had a match against Jeff Hardy. No Bobby Roode to be found. And it was a little awkward, obviously. They made no mention of the fact that he was overseas doing publicity or injured or anything like that. They didn't even have any sort of insert into the show. And apparently, and again, I don't know all the details. I'm just going by what some of the news reports online this morning are saying. But there is some debate as to whether or not the contract expired or whether or not it's just a money issue, but the contract did not expire. I say that because I could have sworn that about a year ago, or maybe 2 years ago, either last year or the year before, I thought that Bobby Roode had re-signed a 5-year deal with the company. And so that's why I'm not going to be so quick to jump on the whole his contract expired bandwagon, which may well be the case. I'm not sure that is. Obviously, there's some sort of issue with money, I would imagine, that's going on here. But if the belief is true, and his contract lapsed because of an oversight by Bruce Pritchard, that's just a disastrous situation. It's disastrous, it's embarrassing, and it harkens back to what happened with Jeff Jarrett in the WWF back in 1999. You may recall Jarrett's contract lapsed because of an oversight by Jim Ross that Jim Ross had to own as his own. He made a mistake. And Jarrett was scheduled to drop the Intercontinental title to China in a Good Housekeeping match. He was feuding with China at the time. And he was scheduled to drop the belt to her at the No Mercy pay-per-view. And I think it was either the day before or the day of the event is when the whole situation with his contract came to light, because WWF was not planning on renewing Jarrett's contract. They were going to let him go. So it's not as though Jarrett lost to China because he held the company up for more money. He was losing no matter what. But because the contract lapsed, he decided, hey, I'm going to hold the company up for more money. And he got, I think it was something like $150,000 or some big amount that he was able to get from them. And then he had a pretty good match with China. He dropped the belt. And, of course, he's been persona non grata to Vince McMahon and WWF ever since. As a matter of fact, the whole reason we even have a TNA today stems from the fact that Jarrett knew he could not go back to WWF after WCW went out of business. So he and his dad started TNA, and we are where we are today. But that's what this sounds like. This sounds, and again, Jarrett was the Intercontinental Champion at that time. He was a solid mid-card guy going into a pretty prominent match on pay-per-view. That was a huge fuck-up on WWF's part. And if the rumors here are to be believed, this is perhaps an even bigger fuck-up on TNA's part, because Bobby Roode is one half of the tag team champions going into one of your biggest shows of the year at the Alamo Dome. You know, Lockdown is now one of only four shows, pay-per-view shows per year. Roode and Aries, to me, right up there with Daniels and Kazarian, probably even more so now, as the hottest act in the company. The most entertaining, for sure. Maybe not the hottest, but certainly the most entertaining to me. They're one of the best parts of TNA television. So I certainly hope that's not the case, or that this can be worked out. I think Bobby Roode's in a pretty good spot in TNA right now, and certainly Austin Aries, who's been knocked down a few pegs, he's no longer contending for the world title. They found a really fun, good role for him as well. I really like the chemistry between the two of them, but you got to ask yourself, if they let this guy's contract expire, he's a homegrown talent, he's one of the biggest stars in the company, he was the longest reigning champion, they claim, in TNA history. Of course, if you really look back in the history, even when it was NWA, TNA. I think Jeff Jarrett, ironically enough, is technically the longest reigning champion, but it doesn't matter. You know, Bobby Roode's a pretty big deal in TNA. He's a talented guy. And it makes me wonder if his contract did expire. Let's say there was no 5-year deal, or there was, but there was an out clause in the contract for him. Could he very well end up in WWE? I mean, obviously, this has been going on for at least 2 weeks now. He hasn't been on television. They must have been negotiating something. Now, today's the big day. Today's the big pay-per-view, and he may well be left off the show. And I don't know what you do in that situation, because they're the defending champions going into this triple threat match. Could Bobby Roode end up in WWE? I don't know how likely that is. What a coup it would be for Vince McMahon if he can snatch away one of TNA's big guys and stick him on the WrestleMania card. I, for one, I wouldn't mind seeing Bobby Roode against Chris Jericho. Or a match like that at WrestleMania. It could happen. I don't know how likely, but it could happen. So this is a breaking news situation. Again, by the time you listen to this, this will have been worked out in some way. Certainly we'll know in a few short hours whether or not he's on the Lockdown card. But, if this is the case, Bruce Pritchard, what the fuck, man? I mean, this is embarrassing, quite frankly. For him, for Dixie Carter, for the whole lot. How do you let something like that happen? In the age of iPhones and smartphones, how do you not set alerts on your phones? You may have to just set alerts on their phones, these people, for every single contract in the company. I set alarms on my phone for everything. I'd forget my own head on my shoulders if I didn't have reminders. There's also rumors floating around this morning about Rob Van Dam's contract, possibly lapsing as well with TNA. He's not on the pay-per-view tonight either. I thought that was a bit odd, especially with an X-Division title match. He just lost the championship to Kenny King. Hasn't gotten a rematch yet. The title change just happened, so they took the title off him. He hasn't gotten a rematch. I don't believe he was on TV this past week, and he's not on the pay-per-view. To me, that's the most glaring omission of all. You would think they would want Rob Van Dam on the show. He ain't on the show either. So perhaps where there's smoke, there's fire to those rumors as well. Did his contract expire? I don't know what's going on over there, but they've got to get their they better get their act together here, because this is just embarrassing. Gail Kim challenges Velvet Sky for the Knockouts title. I'll go with Velvet Sky retaining. Kenny King defends his X Division title against Zema Ion and Christian York in a triple threat match. Figure Kenny King retains here. He just won the championship. I think it's a little too early to take it off him. Robbie E against Robbie T. I'll go with Robbie T in that match, since it looks like they're pushing him again. And Joseph Park against Joey Ryan. This should be an easy win for my boy, Joe Park, who, by the way, you can find a video on his Twitter of him karaokeing to the song My Way, which is the song that Pat Patterson is famous for doing karaoke of at bars after events, and even after some WWE events sometimes off the air. So that's your lockdown rundown for the pay-per-view. Just to talk about the show from Thursday a little bit, I just want to comment on this because it was the final Impact from the Impact Zone, which has been home to the television show since the very first episode in 2004. And it's kind of weird because a lot of people have said stuff about the Impact Zone over the years, myself included. My whole beef with the Impact Zone wasn't with the zone itself. It was with the fact that you're in the same place over and over and over again. The crowds get burned out. It gets, you know, you got to get out of there after a while. You get cabin fever after a while. And they're going on the road now. I think it's a great move. I'm looking forward to seeing what Impact looks like on the road every week. But it is sad. You know, it is sad. The lease is expiring. This was the last show from that location at Universal Studios. And I don't feel they did really enough to acknowledge that on the show. I don't remember the announcers mentioning it at all, in fact. I know they put together a very nice tribute video thanking, you know, the fans of Orlando. It's up on YouTube right now. But they didn't do anything on this show, unless I missed it, to even mention the fact that this was the last show from the Impact Zone, which is weird to me because, you know, if this were WWE, if the shoe were on the other foot, I could see them not mentioning this at all. Like, let's not even mention that. Let's just, you know, pretend that this is not happening. But they made such a big deal about the fact that Impact is going on the road, right? They make such a big deal about it on television that you would think they would acknowledge the fact that this is the last show from the Impact Zone and they would do something special maybe at the end, but they didn't, so that kind of surprised me. Jeff Hardy and Austin Aries opened the show with a very good match. It ended with Matt Morgan running in and mowing Hardy down with a carbon footprint for the DQ. Bully Ray ran down with a chain to make the save for his lockdown opponent. Kurt Angle had waited an entire week to reveal to the world who the VP of Aces and Eights was. It turned out to be D'Lo Brown, who works as an agent, or did, backstage in TNA. Why Kurt Angle felt the need to keep this a secret from management all week and allow D'Lo to return to work and not go after him back? I mean, there's so many questions here. Why didn't Kurt go after D'Lo the minute he walked in the building? You know, obviously D'Lo was back there working as an agent. He ran out there as an agent to break up the brawl with Wes Briscoe and Kurt Angle. You know? And then he kicked Kurt in the nuts. Kurt got exactly what he deserved. If he would have just said something sooner, he wouldn't be nursing a pair of achy balls today. It's his own fault. So yeah, D'Lo Brown is the VP. And you see, this is what happens when Dixie Carter is making all of the hiring decisions in your company. First Vince Russo, now this. And is this not the most random collection of wrestlers ever for a stable? I remember the Job Squad from years ago in WWE and the Union. As well, that was a weird group of guys. I think it was Mankind, Shamrock, Big Show, and Test. And I even remember Vince McMahon coming out with them on TV once, which is hilarious, the idea of Vince McMahon supporting any union. But this Aces and Eights group is something else. You got D-Von, you've got Luke Gallows, you've got Mike Knox, Mr. Anderson, you all know my thoughts on him, Eric Bischoff's son, Taz, who doesn't wrestle, and now D'Lo. I can't call them the worst faction in wrestling history just because we have the Dungeon of Doom in 1995, so it would be impossible for Aces and Eights to be the worst. But it's pretty damn close. They did a series of matches on this show with the participants in Sunday's Lethal Lockdown. TNA guys against Aces and Eights guys in singles matches and tag match too, actually. By the end of the night, Aces and Eights won more matches, so they got the man advantage heading into what basically is a War Games match. Devon pinned Sting after some fan planted at ringside splashed a drink in Sting's face, which led to the finish. At first, I thought maybe it was Sting's face paint that was running from the drink, but it looked like he got himself busted open hard way somewhere in here. I don't exactly know how it happened, but you know, later in the show, he had something on his head to kind of stop the bleeding, and Sting's face was just caked in blood. It was actually a pretty cool visual, although I know it was hard way, but I would have saved the blood for the pay-per-view. But in other matches, Mr. Anderson beat James Storm, Samoa Joe and Magnus beat Doc and Garrett Bischoff after Magnus pinned Doc with the elbow off the top. I'll say it right now, Magnus has a hell of an elbow off the top. He does it much better than CM Punk does. I mean, nobody does it quite like Randy Savage, but Magnus's looks pretty damn impressive, and Punk still, when he does it, just looks way too sloppy and out of control when he's coming off the top. But Magnus, he's got a beautiful elbow off the top. So, and that's the first time I've ever said that another man has a beautiful elbow, by the way. So I don't say that very often, believe me. Danny Davis from OVW has now replaced Taz as a gut check judge. They deliberated backstage about Ivelisse Velez and Lady Tapa. Basically, what I got out of this segment here is that they liked Lady Tapa because her uncle is the Barbarian and she's big. So they picked her to move on to the next round, and they told Ivelisse to hit the bricks, even though she won the match last week. Remember, they had a match last week. Ivelisse won with a submission hold. They were putting her over as this MMA warrior. They praised her because she canceled an MMA fight that she had scheduled just to be there last week for the Gut Check Challenge. Not enough to save her, so she got cut. I think it was the wrong call, obviously. I talked about that on Twitter. I think they made a big mistake here. I think Lady Tapa has a certain presence about her, but to me, she comes off as being really nervous, like she's a novice here, which she is. She's admitted that. She's only been training for about 2 years now. Ivelisse claims she's been training for 9 years, which begs the question, also, on the other hand, if you've been training for 9 years to be a wrestler and you haven't made it yet, what's going on there? But clearly Ivelisse is more polished on camera and in the ring. She's not, you know, the next coming of Trish Stratus or anything like that, but I thought she looked better. But they felt differently. And, you know, frankly, I wouldn't have minded giving them both contracts. I think Lady Tapa has potential. Ivelisse, you probably could have put on TV right away. Tapa came out later for the usual gut check segment in the ring. This was round two. And the crowd hated this poor girl. Hated her. They were not happy that Ivelisse got kicked to the curb. There were loud no chants throughout the impact zone during this entire segment. She was trying to speak. You know, she seemed really caught off guard by it. I kind of felt sorry for her. You know, it wasn't her fault. Al Snow was wearing this unbelievable jacket. You had to see it. He looked like Hugh Hefner out there wearing this red velvet jacket. I don't even know what it was made of exactly, but it was something else. I mean, all he was missing was a cigar in his mouth and some fuzzy slippers. And he could have been wearing the slippers for all I know. His feet were out of camera view, so I couldn't tell. But anyway, Al Snow cast the deciding vote in favor of giving Lady Tapa a contract because of the passionate response, he said, that she evoked from the audience. They do realize that that response was because they wanted the other girl to win, right? I hope they don't expect her to go out there on TV next week and get that same reaction. If she's even on TV, we probably won't even see her for another 6 months, which in this case may actually be for the better. She really needs some more seasoning. I don't think she's ready for prime time just yet. You know, that Taylor Hendricks girl is still down in OVW, I think. She was the first female gut check winner, so I'd send her down there and hopefully she'll get better. Show ended with Jeff Hardy and Bully Ray talking in the ring, hyping their championship match at Lockdown. Hulk Hogan emerged for the final time in the Impact Zone to talk about how TNA has grown into a good little company. That's what he said. Aces and Eights hit the ring. Bunch of TNA guys ran down. We had a big brawl to end the final Impact Zone show. And like I said, I'm surprised they didn't do more to acknowledge this period in company history coming to an end. But they didn't. And we move on from here. Onward and upward. They'll be in Chicago. I think it's specifically Hoffman Estates, Illinois, which I think is just outside Chicago. That'll be live this upcoming Thursday night. Let's get into the mailbag here. You can send me your questions and shout-outs to thesolomonster at gmail.com. This first shout-out here comes from Pastor Rodney. He says, I go all the way back 4 years on your show, by far the best of all I listen to. On Sunday afternoon, I download it and listen to it before my nap. My daughter loved her shout-out last year for her birthday. Her name is Tanis, and she is going to be 17 on March 12th. She also has regional playoffs in basketball this week. This is a big deal in our little state of North Dakota. Could I get a shout-out for her birthday and her basketball team, the LLM Lobos? That's a pretty cool name. Happy birthday, Tanis. Kick butt. Bonita writes in, this is quite belated, but better late than never. I would love for you to give a shout-out to my boyfriend, David, who celebrated his 24th birthday on February 22nd. He listens to your show religiously each week, even when he is at work. Well, that's not good. I love him so much despite his wrestling obsession, and I know he would be thrilled to get a shout-out from you. What's going on, David? Happy birthday to you, my friend. Thank you for listening and being obsessed, according to Bonita, with my show. Obsessing over anything, though, is not good. So hopefully she was saying that tongue-in-cheek. Dave from Southern California started listening to the Sound Off with episode 150. What are your thoughts on Bret Hart's recent comments about AJ Styles saying that he should jump ship to WWE? Though I agree he has nothing more to prove in TNA, he seems too loyal to the company and likely would never leave, even though he could have some great matches in WWE with the likes of Ziggler, Punk, Bryan, etc. The main thing that scares me is that they would not know what to do with his character. Well, then he shouldn't go to WWE, I guess. I don't know what to tell you. You know, it's hit or miss with them. For every Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose who come in with a decent gimmick and get pushed hard, you know, there's a Fandango or a Zack Ryder, you know, who they don't even want to push. Basically, just to give some of the backstory here, for those of you who did not hear the interview, Bret Hart did an interview and was ragging on Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff because he hates them. You know, I mean, he really doesn't care for either one of them. And so then he brought up AJ Styles, and he said that he was, you know, basically AJ is spinning his tires in TNA and that he hopes he doesn't waste his life there. I'm not going to disagree with Bret. You know, name me one real star that TNA has made in the last 10 years. I mean, one guy whose name is known to non-internet fans all over the world. None. Zip. Zero. Zilch. Not one. Even ex-WWE guys who go there fall off the face of the earth to most of those people. Kurt Angle's talked about it before, being stopped on the street, in an airport, wherever, by fans who recognize him, and they ask him, where have you been? You know, what have you been up to? Did you retire? When are you coming back to WWE? So AJ Styles will never be a superstar if he stays in TNA, and that's fine if he's happy there. If he's making good enough money in TNA, he's got a lot of friends there, then I think he should stay there. You know, he had his chance to sign a developmental deal years ago with WWE, and he turned him down. He said no. Probably because he also felt the same way. He either didn't trust them that they would know what to do with him, or he couldn't wrestle the same style of matches there that he's used to wrestling. Whatever his reasons were, he said no. He seems pretty content where he's at right now, you know, and that's cool. I think he should stay put. You know, in many ways, he's like the franchise of TNA. What Sting was to WCW back in the day is what AJ Styles is to TNA. He's been there from the very beginning. They made him a star. He probably does feel a sense of loyalty to them. But he's never going to be making the kind of bread he has the potential to make if he were to get over on television in WWE. I mean, that's a fact. But if that's not important to him, I think he should stay put. Whatever makes you happy. Speaking of David, David Manigo, the son of Silver Spring, writes in, your Zack Ryder rant was awesome, but seriously, the reason he can't buy a pay-per-view match or even a storyline is his gimmick. The Jersey Shore is over. He needs to lose the douchebag gimmick. What are your thoughts? Well, the Jersey Shore may be over, but I don't know. Robbie E finds a way to make it work in TNA. I think that's a cop-out excuse. And I was never a big Robbie E fan, but I, of late, find him to be pretty entertaining. You know, but then again, he's a heel, so it's easy to hate the character. You know, Zack Ryder is just a nerdy babyface. That's his gimmick. That's his shtick. So reinventing himself a bit wouldn't be the worst idea in the world. You know, they could easily take all of this complaining that he's been doing on Twitter and in these news media interviews, and they could turn that into a storyline if they wanted to. We could see the darker side of Zack Ryder. He's a big Princess Leia fan, isn't he? Big Star Wars fan. He's talked about that on his YouTube show.
Come to the dark side, Zack. We have a spot open for you.
Wait a minute. That sounds a lot like the president of Aces and Eights.
It is the president of Aces and Eights. Zack, think about it. We suck. You suck. It's the perfect match. Come, join us.
All right, enough of that. Thank you, President of Aces and Eights. Moving on here. Sean from Dublin, Ireland writes in, I've been a fan of the Sound Off since just after WrestleMania 27 and haven't missed a show since. This is my very first time emailing the show, and it's with good reason I send this email. I was wondering if I can get a shout-out as I will be starting my journey towards becoming a pro wrestler this Wednesday, March 13th, assuming my health checks back okay. And it would mean a great deal to me to get a shout-out on the air this week. I also want to thank you for the amazing work you do with your show, as it has become the highlight of my wrestling week. Keep up the good work. Thank you, Sean. I appreciate that. And good luck. You know, I can't tell you how many aspiring wrestlers have written into me over the years, both on the air and off. If even half of them make it one day to WWE, I'll know everything that happens behind the scenes in that company. They'll hate me as much as they hate Meltzer or Keller. I could just see it. So, good luck, Sean. Anthony from Brunswick, Maryland. I've been a fan of the show since episode 152 and wanted to give a shout-out to my former boss, Matt Keating, who, were it not for him, I would not know who the Solemn Monster is. With the passing of Paul Bearer, who do you think, should be the one to induct Undertaker into the Hall of Fame? My friends seem to think it will be Kane, but I think it would be either Shawn Michaels, who he retired, or the million-dollar man Ted DiBiase for bringing him into WWE. Well, both would be fine choices, although I would go of the two with Shawn, just because, you know. Yeah, DiBiase brought him in, that's true, but there's no real connection between them beyond that. I'd also throw Mick Foley's name out there as another possibility. I think he may be Undertaker's finest opponent. You know, it's between him and Shawn, as far as I'm concerned. But I'm thinking it'll probably be Kane. I think that would make the most sense. He'd be the one I'd go with. Jesse Wagstaff turned 18 on March 7th, so happy birthday, Jesse. Longtime fan of the show. I appreciate your support. Michael Avila from Redlands, California. I was wondering if I could get a shout-out from my girlfriend, Amy, who just had a birthday this week. Well, happy birthday, Amy. I've been listening to the Sound Off since episode 156, and Amy has also started listening to the show. She's even picked up on some wrestling lingo lately, calling me a mark for the Solemn Monster when I get a new episode of the Sound Off downloaded to my iPhone. Well, you know, Jim Ross might call her a Jezebel, but I would never do such a thing. He says, in May of 1990, Hulk Hogan was injured by Earthquake on the Brother Love Show and was taken off TV. Do you know if this was done so that Hogan could film a movie? A friend of mine believes he was written off because of the steroid trial against Vince McMahon, but I'm pretty sure the steroid allegations came out to the public a few years later in 1992. Well, there were always allegations, but the steroid stuff did not really start to hit the fan until the following year in 91. And then 92, yeah, you're right about that. Hogan took that big sabbatical for about a year. He disappeared in 92 into 93, and that had everything to do with steroids and just Hogan had a terrible public image at that point. He had gone on the Arsenio Hall show and lied about taking steroids and became something of a poster child for it. So for PR reasons, they just had to get him off TV. So that's what happened in 92. But as far as the Earthquake thing in 90, I'm pretty sure it was a movie. I want to say it was Suburban Commando that he was filming, which that movie came out the following year. It was later the following year, but still, that's usually what happens. I mean, he took time off in 88 after WrestleMania 4 to go film No Holds Barred. That's the only reason Macho Man ended up with the title, because Hogan had to go film a movie, so Hogan was cool with it. Hogan went to go film No Holds Barred. That movie came out the following year as well. So it was probably the same situation. And Michael's second question, short and sweet here, would you add more members to the Shield, and if so, who? I would not add anyone to the Shield. I think they're fine just the way they are. James, a listener since episode 10, is Rey Mysterio still a big merchandise draw? I asked this in response to this latest injury reported by SC Scoops earlier in the week. Was wondering when WWE chooses to simply move on from Rey. If he sells enough merchandise, fine, then keep him, but if he's just taking up space on the roster, why not future endeavor him? Whoa. Easy there, Quick Draw McGraw. I mean, one more wellness failure and you won't have to worry about that, but I wouldn't fire the guy. I mean, even if I do agree that it may be time for him to hang up the mask, let's say he retires, okay? He does go ahead and retire. If I'm WWE, I still want him under contract. I don't want him going to TNA or back down to Mexico and making money for somebody else. Now, Mysterio probably does still sell quite a bit of merchandise with the masks and everything. He's still a huge star, especially with the kids. You don't just let a guy like that go because he keeps getting hurt on your watch. I know Rey isn't a Vince McMahon creation like The Undertaker, but can you imagine saying that about him? Undertaker is so broken down now, he can barely move, he keeps getting hurt, he only wrestles once a year, so let's get rid of him. Honestly, I mean, Rey probably sells more merch than The Undertaker does. Why not get rid of him, too? It's just a preposterous thought. I mean, Rey is in that same class. He's a legend. He was a top guy who put his body through hell for the company. He put his body through hell long before that, quite frankly, but he still put it through the meat grinder for WWE. Maybe he doesn't want that, you know? Maybe he doesn't want to stay with WWE. Maybe they come to him with the idea of being an ambassador or something, and he says, screw you, I still want to wrestle. I'm going to let my contract expire and go make money in Mexico. I'll go to AAA. Fine. If that's what he wants to do, then his contract expires. He's more than welcome to do that, but I wouldn't cut him from his contract before it's expired. I think that's crazy. Noel Radigan from Galway, Ireland. Well, that's interesting. There's a big bar here in New York called Galway Hooker. I think the name comes from some type of boat, but I could be wrong. Perhaps Noel can shed some light on that. He says, I've been a listener since the fall of 2010, and this is the first time I have emailed a question. Can't remember the exact episode number I started listening, perhaps the early 140s, but the first sound up I heard was the one where Lawler and Cole were fed up with Matt Stryker as an announcer. Well, they weren't the only ones. My question is about setting up WrestleMania 30's main event a year in advance. On Monday, John Cena, in a nutshell, said that if he beats Rock at WrestleMania 29, he will be the greatest of all time, because he will have beaten everybody there is to beat. But there is one obvious name missing, The Undertaker. Let's say Cena wins, and the next night he comes out and says that it was the biggest victory of his career, and he is the greatest. Which, in fairness, I don't think John Cena would ever do that, but okay, let's pretend that he does say that. Then he is interrupted by The Undertaker, who says, you're not the greatest until you've beaten me at WrestleMania. I've heard people say that Cena should be heel for the match, but as you've said before on the Sound Off, a babyface Cena would make the streak ending feel more believable. So I would suggest turning Undertaker heel. He could torment Cena for the next year, costing him title matches, and when the two meet at Mania, I feel that more people would buy the fact that Cena could actually beat Undertaker and end the streak. There are some flaws, obviously, with a year-long build, the main one being that Cena would have to go the year pretty much unbeaten unless Taker is around to cost him matches. I am interested to hear your views on this, although I feel you won't agree with Undertaker being the heel. I don't agree with any of this other than the match itself. I do think Undertaker's final WrestleMania opponent should be John Cena. You know, he's the biggest star of the modern era. I think that's a big match. Here's the problem when you announce the match a year in advance. First of all, let's see if Undertaker can even get through a match with CM Punk. He may wrestle this year and realize, that's it, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. Also, even if he comes back for one more match, he's not going to be around making appearances and shooting angles throughout the year, as you suggest. Turning him heel at this point in his career, I mean, it's just insanity. It's insane. It's like Ric Flair. All he wants to do, even now, he wants to be a heel on TV, and they won't let him because people are not going to boo the Nature Boy. It's just, it ain't going to happen. Same thing with The Undertaker. People are not going to boo the guy, especially if he's not around enough to really get the heel turn over and do, you know, evil, heelish things that would get people to hate him in the first place. I mean, my God, at least Shawn Michaels kicked Hulk Hogan in the face, and then he got to cut that amazing heel promo on the fans in Montreal that one Raw back in 05. But even that wasn't a real heel turn because most of the fans didn't want to boo Shawn Michaels. There's no way Undertaker should be turning heel at this stage of his career. But here's my biggest issue with the one-year build. And I shouldn't even say that because if WWE has a match in mind for the following year's WrestleMania and they want to build to it over the course of a year like a slow build, I think that's great. That's long-term booking. That's what they did with Hogan and Savage from 88 to 89. But it's not like they came out the night after WrestleMania 4 and said, hey, next year it's going to be Hulk Hogan against the Macho Man. They built an alliance between them that eventually went sour, they broke up, and it led to the match. It's a very different situation. It's different than saying, okay, let's announce the match now, and then we'll figure out how we want to get there over the next 12 months. That's way too much TV time to devote to a guy who's never even going to be around. So you announce this match, and now you're going to give the people 12 months to debate different scenarios. What kind of shocking finish can they come up with? Nah, they won't do that because it's too predictable. You know, and then by the time the match comes, everybody's disappointed because it's been a year, and they did the most predictable finish, let's say, and they're like, oh, that's it? So now people feel let down. You know, having two or three solid months to build that match, I think, is more than enough. They don't need a year-long build. And Cena shouldn't go heel either. Just do the match. And if Undertaker wants to put Cena over on his way out, which is how they did business back in the old days, I think I'd be okay with that. And if Taker retires with the streak intact, I'd be okay with that too. In fact, I'd probably prefer it that way. All right, last question. Matt I writes in, I just finished listening to episode 263 of The Sound Off. All I can say regarding your insightful yet blunt words for Zack Ryder is hallelujah. I've been a loyal listener since for about 2 years now. Episode 156 was the first one that hooked me. Do you think WWE should create a storyline based around Jack Swagger's DUI arrest? The reason I ask is because one of your listeners wrote in last week and pointed out some large plot holes in the anti-immigration storyline with Del Rio. These plot holes actually make Swagger and Zeb look sympathetic, while Del Rio looks stupid and almost heelish. I'm proposing that WWE bring the whole DUI thing to light. The guy fucked up in a big way and at the worst possible time in his career, so why not roll with it? Portray Swagger as some ne'er-do-well who operates with total impunity and thinks he's above authority. The character seems closer to the real Jack Swagger than the patriotic one they keep shoving down our throats each and every week. Hey, I hear you. You know, remember my party boy gimmick I pitched for Swagger months before he came back? I wouldn't have gone in this direction with the immigration stuff. Remember Kevin Eck, the Baltimore Sun reporter who joined WWE Creative a couple of years ago? He was the one who I said wouldn't last more than 8 months or something, and he's still there. Apparently, this storyline was his brainchild. This was his idea. And I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I mean, he's trying to take a hot-button current events issue and tie it and weave it into a wrestling storyline and figure it might create controversy, which it did for about a week. And now it's just a storyline that, quite frankly, doesn't really have a lot of juice to it as far as I'm concerned. I mean, Zeb has been great in his role. Forget the content of it. I think Dutch Mantell in this character has been great. And my hope is that once this angle has run its course, or if Swagger loses, let's say, at WrestleMania, and they don't keep this thing going, if he doesn't win the title, I hope they can find another role for him. If Zeb can just stay Swagger's manager, and they can just drop the whole immigration thing, and he's just a friend who manages him, or maybe they do a split, and Coulter manages somebody else, I don't know. I would just hate for him to only be in temporarily, because I think he's so good. It's good to see him back on TV, too. He's a great talker. And I hope they keep him around. But anyway, that was kind of the whole idea, I think, behind doing this immigration thing, and it was Kevin Eck's idea. I hear what you're saying, but I wouldn't do it. I think it's a bad move. I'm fine with embarrassing Swagger as part of his punishment, which apparently he hasn't been punished. I mean, maybe they yelled at him. I don't know. I'm not backstage, but he's on TV every week. He's still going to WrestleMania. He's still getting a title match, even though he got busted for DUI. But to me, it's more embarrassing for the company to even bring more attention and scrutiny to the fact that one of their performers was arrested for DUI. That story's already died down in the media. Why draw more attention to it? And draw more attention to the fact that you're celebrating this type of behavior by turning it into a storyline. It sends a bad message. I mean, hell, somebody like Zack Ryder may see that and think it's okay to go get hopped up on Bud Light Limes and get in his car figuring, hey, at least I'm finally going to get a push on TV. If there's one thing more frightening than that Hosky music video he did, it's the thought of a depressed Zack Ryder behind the wheel, drunk off a six-pack of Bud Light Lime. We don't need that. Nobody does. All right, that's going to do it for the mailbag here. Thank you, as always, for the questions. Very insightful stuff this week. You can email me at thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. When emailing, please try to include how long you've been listening for the show, to the show for, or if you remember the episode number or a good estimate of when you've been listening. It's always fun to know. So please include that in your emails. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemnmonster. Thank you for those who helped me break the 2,000 barrier. Now we march to 2,100, so I need all your help. Follow me, @Solemonster. You could also friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolemonster. We have a very active, lively Raw thread each and every week on there for pay-per-views. I'm sure the WrestleMania thread's going to be huge. And you can only be part of that discussion if you friend me on there. So facebook.com/thesolemonster. You can subscribe to my YouTube channel. My username on there is thesolemonster, all one word. Again, I'm still planning on putting up the next vintage episode of The Sound Off from 07 and some other stuff. Just bear with me here. I've been very busy of late. And you can also subscribe to The Sound Off, what you're listening to right now, in iTunes. Type in the name of the show. You can subscribe every time a new episode goes up. It will be automatically downloaded for you. If you would please leave a review for the show on iTunes, I would very much appreciate that. I know I've said that before. I know some of you still have not. Please leave your thoughts. Give the show a star rating. It's very helpful to us. And also, don't forget, I am a contributor to JBL's website, layfieldreport.com. I have my latest column on the Layfield Report on Paul Bear, my thoughts and memories of Uncle Paul, remembering a great man. That's up right now on Layfield Report. And every Sunday night, or sometimes Monday morning, it depends when they actually get it up. Sometimes I'll submit it and it doesn't go up until the next day. But after each episode of The Walking Dead each week, I do a blog about the show, which is the best show on television right now, in my opinion, of course. So if you are a Walking Dead fan, or even if you're not, but you enjoy my work, you can check out the Walking Dead blog on Layfield Report at the end of each weekend as well. There'll be a new one going up after this weekend's episode. So that's going to do it for episode 264 of The Sound Off. Thank you, as always, for joining me. Episode 265 coming up next week. You know, I still remember when I did episode 65. Episode 65 was a double episode. The first part was my WrestleMania 25 review, and then I think the second part was a normal show. And now it's episode 265 next week, and it just blows my mind. Blows my mind. Time flies. Till then, be well, stay safe, enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll see you right back here next weekend for more of The Sound Off here on SEScoops.com. Take care, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster sounds off on SEScoops.com.